You're listening to a podcast from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
Okay, welcome everyone. I'm Fred Wary, a senior associate at the Middle East program at the Carnegie Endowment. And on behalf of Carnegie and also our co-sponsors, the project on Middle East Democracy, I wanted to welcome you to this conference on the dynamic Gulf, forces of change in a strategic region. I also wanted to thank you for braving the capricious weather to attend this discussion on an equally unpredictable region. As our title suggests, we take as a starting point that the Gulf, and here we mean the Arab states of the Gulf Cooperation Council, is a region in the throes of important change. Certainly, this change may not be as dramatic or as violent as the tumult that we see afflicting other parts of the Arab world, but it is important change nonetheless. In the wake of the seismic upheavals of 2011, much energy was devoted to explaining why the tumult had bypassed this region. A number of explanations were offered, of course. Oil rents, a small and relatively homogeneous populations of these states, high standards of living, strong support from an external patron, the United States, robust and loyal security forces, the resiliency of monarchy, tribal and familial bonds, the list goes on. In many respects, these arguments are simply a continuation of a long-standing school of thought that has long maintained that the Gulf is an exceptional corner of the Middle East that is somehow immune to the dynamics that are unfolding elsewhere in the region. On the flip side, at the other end of the spectrum, others have built their reputation on predicting the imminent collapse of the Gulf political order as it is currently construed. They point to a number of worrisome trends that taken in total seem to suggest a perfect storm that is arriving on this region. New social and political actors are challenging previously sacrosanct norms against criticizing the ruling families in this region. There's a burgeoning and increasingly educated youth population that is questioning whether the old social contract of the welfare state will be able to deliver the standard of living enjoyed by previous generations. The time-worn practice of dispersing subsidies, duplicate dissent, in many instances appears to be producing diminishing returns. There are new levels of identity politics and sectarianism afflicting this region. And among Gulf rulers, there are nagging questions about the durability of external partnerships, specifically with the United States. I think this conference aims for somewhat of a more subtle and nuanced middle ground. We want to really characterize the nature of these changes, whether they emanate from the top down or from below. To do this, I think we've assembled really a top-notch cast of speakers representing a wide range of backgrounds and viewpoints, one of whom is joining us from the region itself, from eastern Saudi Arabia, Ahmed Omran. We're going to start with panel one by taking into account new trends by those demanding change from below, reformists and oppositionists in the region. What are the new actors that have emerged since 2011? The new forms of organization and networks, the enabling technologies, what are their goals? What are some of the challenges and debates and obstacles that these actors have faced? And very broadly and somewhat crudely, we've categorized these as youth, women, and Islamists. But of course, the field is open to discussion, and I look forward to hearing this panel. The second panel will address what we call efforts to construct a new ruling bargain, meaning how have regimes and elites adapted to changes in the region? How have governments and their supporters managed change by pursuing a wide array of strategy, some co-optive, some quite repressive, and some characterized by very gradual and calibrated reforms in the political and economic realm? And I look forward to some intense debate about the nature of those reforms and whether they are, in fact, sufficient. And the final panel is meant to really offer a comprehensive wrap-up of some of the key themes of these discussions, and also where is the region heading? What do these trends mean for the stability of the Gulf order? If change is coming, what form will that change take? And importantly, what are the implications of this for the Gulf's principal and longstanding patron, the United States? We've asked our speakers to keep their remarks at 10 to 15 minutes, so I would encourage all of you to consider this meeting a dialogue and ask plenty of questions. I would implore you, however, to please ask a question rather than delivering a homily out of respect for others who want to engage as well. And I would also encourage everyone to tweet the proceedings. I see our guest from Saudi Arabia, Ahmed, has already done that quite proficiently. We have a screen that you may have seen out there that will display all of your tweets to the public under the hashtag Dynamic Gulf. And finally, please do silence your cell phones. And at this point, I'll turn it over to my co-sponsor, Stephen McInerney of POMED, who will moderate the first panel. Thank you.
Okay, thanks very much, Fred. We're excited to be co-hosting this conference today, and we're going to get started, as Fred just outlined, with a discussion of new trends in activism, what kind of some of the major important new actors and players and movements are that emerged in the Gulf in recent months and years. We have an excellent panel to get us started this morning. Our first speaker is going to be Kristen Smith-Dewan. She's an assistant professor of comparative and regional studies at American University School of International Service. She's focused for quite some time on a lot of the changing movements in the Gulf, including Islamist movements in the Gulf. She's going to be looking this morning at Islamist movements, including particularly the Muslim Brotherhood in several of the Gulf countries, and also how the emergence and change of Islamists in the movements in the region have interacted with the kind of burgeoning youth population and looking especially at kind of the younger generation of Islamists in the region. Our second speaker this morning is going to be Jane Kenenmont. Jane is visiting us from the UK, where she's a senior fellow focusing on the Middle East at Chatham House. She has also focused extensively on the GCC states for some time, including economic issues. She's going to focus especially this morning on the changes to the role of women and women's participation in political activism, in party politics, and how that's changed in recent years and what the role of women is today in the Gulf. And then our third speaker joining us live from the Eastern Province in Saudi Arabia is Ahmed Al-Omran. He's a Saudi blogger and journalist. His blog Saudi Jeans has been one of the most widely read blogs from Saudi Arabia and from the Gulf for several years. I also had the opportunity to get to know Ahmed when he was living here in Washington, working for NPR. His writing has also been extensively published in both in Arabic and in English, including in Western publications such as the New York Times and the Guardian. So with that, I'll turn it over to Kristen to get us started.
Thank you, Stephen, and I want to start by thanking POMED and also Fred and the Carnegie Endowment for hosting us here. And I also especially want to thank them for organizing this conference under this theme of the Dynamic Gulf. And I really like the title of this because I think it, right directly from the upstart and from the title, pushes back against a really strong meta-narrative that's been established, I think, in this era of the Arab Spring. Which is that with all of this tumult, with all of these dramatic changes that are happening across the Arab world, we still have sort of the Gulf sitting aside as this area, sort of almost like an island of stability and to some extent even like stasis. And I think that's really different from a lot of what those of us who study the Gulf and are looking at the Gulf and people living in the Gulf have experienced this period, where they really have seen a lot of changes taking place, really important changes that are taking place. And many of these changes, and in fact, are based in broader structural things that are happening in societies in the Gulf that, in fact, mirror things that are happening in some of the other states that have, you know, experienced more, you know, uprisings and actual overturnings of governments. And so with my comments with you here today in my short time, I wanted to really focus on one narrow area that I've been looking at, which is the shifting dynamics or the shifting terrain in Islamic activism in the Gulf. And I want to focus on this especially looking at another theme that's come up and definitely has been seen in other areas, which is the really strong generational divide and the importance of youth in a lot of, in pushing for a lot of change in these states. And if we look at this then again, This is something that when we think about youth and this generational divide and Islamic activism, this is something that was really studied and commented on and a lot of people have written about in Egypt and became a really important element, I think, in the January 25th uprising when you had a lot of scholars like Harry Wickham and Khalil Anani talking about this generational divide that you saw within the Muslim Brotherhood, in particular, the emergence of a sort of blogging generation of younger brothers who are chafing under the hierarchy of the Muslim Brotherhood. And these divisions really did become apparent in January 25th when you saw these younger members really pushing to go out in front to join the protest and to try to find bonds of kind of linking across to other more secular activists. And of course, we've seen it in the aftermath of the revolution, too, as some of these people have actually left the Muslim Brotherhood and formed new trends. And although it's been much less kind of written about or commented on, you see some of these same trends happening in Gulf states as well, and particularly in Muslim Brotherhood movements, where, for instance, in Kuwait, you've seen defectors from the Muslim Brotherhood playing a really prominent role in forming organizations and impressing new forms of activism in the streets, things that hadn't been seen very much in the Gulf states, or in particular in Kuwait, new forms of protest and trying to normalize these kinds of protests and also looking for new forms of organization beyond Muslim Brotherhood that take more of a view of like a civil state. And in fact, this activism and pressure by some of these young groups were successful in working, kind of pushing a street campaign that linked up with a lot of what was happening in the parliament that actually successfully ousted the prime minister, Sheikh Nasser Mohammed al-Sabah, who is a royal, obviously the prime minister, in November 2011. So even having some success in kind of pushing for change. So what I want to do in the spirit of kind of the remarks that Fred said and taking a deeper look at this is to kind of look at some of the precursors to this and thinking about what exactly is driving this, what is happening amongst youth populations, what kind of challenges is this presenting to Islamist movements, and do we really see changes happening in the Islamist movements themselves to address this? And I'll be focusing most of my remarks on my work that I've been looking at is in Muslim Brotherhood related movements, but I'll try in my final comments to show that this is a trend that's happening even outside of movements like that. And some of these challenges, I think, are noteworthy for the Muslim Brotherhood in particular, because, as you know, if you think about the Muslim Brotherhood as an organization, it's gotten a reputation for being, you know, people to comment on its prowess at organizing and mobilizing and these sorts of things. But on the other hand, it is sort of in its main structure and its origins was a very sort of old school organization, right, that it arose in competition and in looking at other sort of Leninist organizations where they wanted to establish really authority in this elite vanguard of the people and the main authority in the Muslim Brotherhood that was emerging basically as kind of people get older and rise through the organization in this very kind of rigid structure. The emphasis on organization and recruitment, the emphasis on education, on dawah, but in some sense also doctrination, to have a very strong message that unifies across the organization and keeps the organization, keeps that kind of control. And of course, we know throughout the history of the Muslim Brotherhood as well, we've seen a kind of history of secrecy, of kind of keeping what's happening inside the organization out of the view of other people. And I think many of these kind of elements are at odds with a lot of changes that are taking place, that, as we know, in societies, and a lot of new demands that are coming up that are especially reflective in young populations. We've seen, of course, tremendous increase in consumerism and then the emphasis on sort of more personal preferences, tremendous penetration now of internet and social media, which has a very different sort of frame to it of openness and outreach and kind of multivalence linking to a lot of different people, which is giving a lot more options for engagement across and to meet and to interact with very different people who think very differently. And so parallel to these kind of social changes, then there's a change in orientation, too, where we see in a lot of young populations much more value placed on individual action, personal preference and initiative, to some degree greater expectation of transparency or at least respect for debate, and less sort of exclusivity. And due to this, then we've seen real challenges for Muslim Brotherhood movements in continuing to attract and to hold a lot of the youth populations, which is, of course, you know, what the main kind of outreach of these organizations has always been, on focusing on the youth and educating the youth and bringing them into these larger organizations. And I just wanted to share with you some examples of things that I've noticed in going to the region and meeting with young activists and other people in the Muslim Brotherhood, of changes that are happening inside of these organizations. So, and in order to kind of hold these more youthful populations. So, for instance, if you look in Saudi Arabia, there's been, within Muslim Brotherhood networks, there's been a real decision to allow for more tolerance, to give a bit more independence to some of the kind of middle generation activists who have different means of appealing to the youth. And you can see use of new technologies, use of television, internet television, and in creative ways that will attract the youth in different ways. Some of them using, for instance, music and music videos in ways that you wouldn't normally associate with, like, a Muslim Brotherhood movement, the kind of music that still is incorporating values but incorporating kind of newer, younger pop singer types. It reminds me a lot of sort of Christian rock that you find in the United States, this kind of way of appealing and attracting people. You also see emphasis on new kinds of organization instead of the kind of top-down, we think about NGOs and this sort of outreach where it's a top-heavy organization. There's been a real trend in Saudi Arabia, not just in the Muslim Brotherhood, but there's one movement that's really used this in volunteerism. So very much having people kind of dedicate, find things that they're interested in, much more an individual initiative, project-based things where they can, you know, see where their talents lie and contribute to that, which I think is as well in line with these broader trends. If we look at some other states in Kuwait and the Muslim Brotherhood, there was sort of another move that was taken to satisfy and to keep a lot of the young and more ambitious young members engaged within the Muslim Brotherhood. And this happened under the tutelage of Tariq Usweidan, who is himself a very interesting sort of middle generation activist who has many new ideas. And who has done a lot from his background in incorporating ideas that he learned in marketing and in leadership studies and in management, these kind of new things, linking them into the idea of Islamism and presenting Islamism in new ways. And in fact, you had within the Muslim Brotherhood organization then a special track for talented young people where they would come under his tutelage and learn these leadership skills, so kind of giving them a special status within the organization as a way to keep them still underneath the movement itself. And they would introduce then these young leaders and go around and travel and meet other important Islamic leaders. I know that the group went and met with Prime Minister Erdogan, for instance, in Turkey, so kind of keeping them abreast of things and raising them in a sort of different way within the organization. In Qatar, a much more radical approach was taken. Maybe some of you know that the Muslim Brotherhood organization was actually dissolved as a formal political organization in 1999 as a decision of the leader of the movement at that time, Jassima Sultan, and the leadership council. And what's really interesting, I mean, I've met several times with Dr. Sultan, was just his broad analysis that this indeed organization was the form of the organization was a bit out of touch with what the current era was. Why did they have this need for secrecy when they didn't have major problems with the government? It didn't fit the thing. And why the sort of top-down engagement with Islamism when he wanted to see a lot more discussion taking place? And so he was instrumental in initiating an entirely new project called the Al-Nahda Project, which had, I think, represents and pulls together a lot of these different elements. It was an open enrollment program where youth could come and enroll in the program. It involved a lot much more critical engagement with Islamic heritage. And very importantly, there was a real strong emphasis on action and on individual action, so that people who come to the program actually come with their own projects, something that they think needs addressing within society. And part of the project, the whole program then, is to think about how they can use the Islamic heritage and think about this to bring about a greater renaissance in society through their own personal projects. And these projects then were not followed up upon. The individuals are kind of on their own once they've done that. So again, much less control hierarchy than what you've seen in your father's sort of Muslim Brotherhood movement. So why should we care about all of these interest, you know, changes that are happening? I think one thing that it would direct us to is to broaden our view and thinking about people who are influential and that could have a prominent stake in influencing this younger generation. And I would look more to a number of personalities, not directly politicians, but different sort of personalities who have been very savvy at using new media and using these kind of approaches that really appeal to youth. In Saudi Arabia, someone who really stands out, who would be a prominent person to look at, would be Sheikh Salman Al Ouda, who, of course, has made use of many different kinds of technologies, from having his own TV program where he could, in a very sort of personal way, appeal to people and have a much broader appeal even outside of Saudi Arabia, to since he was supportive of the uprising in Egypt and lost his television program, has made extensive use of new media, Twitter and these sorts of things, and has great appeal amongst a lot of these sort of new generations. Another reason why I think we should look at this is it does reflect, in a way, a lot of frustration that young people are feeling with these movements. And of course, in some areas, the Muslim Brotherhood has been successful in holding them, and some they haven't. And as I mentioned, in Egypt, we've seen, in Kuwait, we've seen the formation of new movements. One of the defectors has created a new movement called the Civil Democratic Movement, which I think is the first kind of youth-oriented civil movement in the Gulf, kind of a formal political society that's been very, very active and really, like I said, pushing the envelope in political protest in ways that we didn't see before, and was, in fact, one of the first organizations to start demanding for a constitutional monarchy and an elected government in Kuwait, and really putting that at the top of their political demands, which is something that has been adopted by much of the broader opposition movement now in Kuwait. I think also this speaks to a broader trend when you think about these social changes that are taking place that are noteworthy, because we see that a lot of the instruments that governments have used, or a lot of the intermediaries that governments have used to interact with society and to kind of get their message across. And I would include Islamic movements in that. I mean, most Islamic movements in the Gulf have not been strictly oppositional movements by any means, but have very strong relationships with the government. And it's interesting to see then in certain cases where the Islamic movements are in a way not able to even fully control their own cadres, if you will. And this was very apparent when you look in Bahrain, for instance, of course, on more the Shia equation, with Al-Wifaq, an important movement that had done a lot to kind of work with the government and look for accommodation. But you had a lot of frustration with young people who broke aside and then formed the February 14th movement, which, of course, was the main movement that led to the uprising in that country. We can see this even outside of Islamic movements as well, in tribal intermediaries, and a lot of changes that are taking place in tribes, and where governments have been trying to use tribes to mediate and kind of reach out to these young people. Sometimes they're just left off. This was the case in Oman, where some of the protesters in Sohar, the government tried to sort of send these old tribal leaders to speak to them, and they were actually kind of ridiculed. And it also was the case, we can see that in Kuwait as well, where the old sort of intermediaries of tribes, now we see a lot of tribes playing leadership roles in the opposition and refusing to work through sort of the old networks. So those are just a few of the trends that I see that are based on much kind of deeper social major changes that are taking place within the region, but that are starting to bubble up and show up on this level of contestation and of politics, formal politics within the Gulf.
Okay. Thanks very much. I'll turn to Jane.
Thank you. Good morning, everyone. So to put this in a bit of context, I certainly also strongly agree with this framework of seeing the Gulf as a dynamic place. This is a region of the world that's seen very, very dramatic changes in the past 4 decades since most of the Gulf states became independent, in terms of the population, in terms of the nature of the economy, standards of living, levels of education, openness to migration and the outside world, and the availability of information. So it would be extremely unlikely for any countries to be able to go through these multi-dimensional social, demographic, and economic and informational changes without also seeing changes in politics. And even if we see currently very limited changes in formal political structures, activism and political organisation and political expression certainly are dynamic spaces in all of the Gulf countries. But these things aren't entirely new. And I think one of the first points that I want to make is that activism in the Gulf isn't a recent phenomenon. It certainly didn't start with the Arab uprisings. That's not always obvious to observers of the Gulf from overseas, who often see these countries as places that are completely top-down, oil-rich, where citizens have very little say, largely work for the government, and so on. But there are longer histories of political organisation and activism, especially over the past 100 years. And there are recurring themes in terms of popular demands that come up over time, although the ideological and organisational form that these take evolves and changes with each generation, and taking into account the opportunities that are available at different times. There are recurring demands for changes to the distribution of power and wealth, and themes that recur include demands for greater political representation, greater inclusion, judicial reforms, which you can see looking back to constitutional movements in the 1920s. There have been labour movements demanding greater pay, greater protection. Labour movements, of course, have been weakened since the expansion of the oil states and the increased dependence of the economies on migrant workers with few rights. But there is a tradition of unions and professional associations being important. Another theme that's come up over and over again has been a criticism of Western dominance and of the sense that ruling elites, because they are dependent usually on external protection for security, pay too much heed to the wishes of the West. This came up, of course, first with the British Empire and latterly more with the presence of the US military, especially after 1991. So there are these recurring themes, but the forms change over time, partly depending on what works and what doesn't work. People experiment with different forms. We saw at different times the use of unions, the use of popular committees, political parties, informal groups that would get together in clubs or in diwanias or majalis, which are salon-type regular gatherings in people's houses. What we've seen, I think, in the past couple of years since 2011 has been that even in the countries with the most developed parliamentary systems, which are Bahrain and Kuwait, there has been a frustration on the part of opposition groups and people that are demanding change with the limited options available for making change happen through formal political processes, where informally power still remains very heavily concentrated in the hands of the ruling family. And as Kristen, I think, already alluded to, part of what we saw in the uprising in Bahrain was a reaction against and a challenge to the political parties that were participating in the parliaments. And a phenomenon that we see today in common with many of the other Arab countries is a focus by young people on leaderless political movements, which has pros and has cons. One of the reasons for focusing on a decentralised and leaderless movement is that it reduces the risk that governments can either repress a movement by arresting a small number of leaders or co-opt a movement by giving those leaders jobs. So it reduces the chance of an uprising or movement being stopped, but it also reduces the prospects for negotiations and for demands to be achieved that way, because it's very unclear who, if anyone, has the legitimacy to speak for activists and speak for wider movements. The ideological forms that activism has taken have also changed over time. And certainly the dominant feature in the Gulf and the wider region today is political Islam. But that's certainly not something innate or permanent. The dominant groups going back to the 50s and 60s were leftist and Arab nationalist groups. But for a variety of reasons, those movements were not perceived to have succeeded for people. And there's an open question, a debate that will probably be quite dominant over the next decade or more, about what exactly might come after Islamist movements, if Islamist movements are also seen to be failing to achieve change or to be dividing society. Because one of the concerning trends that we see with Islamist popular movements in the region is the rising levels of sectarianism and the divisions that that's creating within societies. So in terms of academic literature that's relevant, I'd highly recommend looking at Asif Bayat, the sociologist who's written about the notion of post-Islamism, particularly with reference to Iran, but talking about where people go next after frustration with the traditional Islamist movements. So as I mentioned, a lot of what's going on is not entirely new, but it is taking different forms. One of the things that is quite a new trend in activism in the Gulf countries is the rising involvement of women in political activism. Most of the spaces and organisational types that I alluded to before, committees, unions, clubs, political parties, they've tended to be spaces that were available mainly to men. And an interesting tension that we've seen in the past couple of years has been in the countries with the biggest protest movements, in Bahrain and Kuwait, women have been taking an increasingly prominent role and have also been relatedly involved in repression, tear gas, sent to prison, etc. That generation of young women want something in return, but in a way they're struggling on two fronts. Not only are they coming up against government repression, they also still are not really being represented in formal political leadership or political parties that purport to represent the opposition. Instead, they're seeking informal representation. They're seeking to make their voices heard at the forefronts of street protests, or you're seeing very prominent women activists using social media, using Twitter, using YouTube statements, and also seeking to get a voice in the international policy debate around the Gulf. You have seen the parliaments in Bahrain and in Kuwait begin to open up to women. Women were given the vote in 2002 in Bahrain and 2006 in Kuwait. They still represent usually small minorities in parliament, and the women MPs that are there tend to have a relatively good relationship with government. They tend to be heavily supported by government and often relatedly to be pro-government. And one of the arguments that non-democratic governments in the Gulf, like elsewhere in the region, use against democracy is that democratic movements would disempower women and other minorities. This is obviously a deeply problematic argument. The empowerment of minorities by authoritarian regimes is often very tokenistic and based on a very narrow definition of women's rights as something different from other human and civil rights. But it is a major challenge that opposition movements should be thinking about, should be working on hard, and if they don't make those changes themselves, that may also weaken them and lead them to be eclipsed by other movements in the longer run. Another thing that's changed, that we can say is profoundly new about the current wave of activism in the Gulf, is the access to media, international and social media, and the availability of information has changed very profoundly since the previous generation. On a recent visit to Bahrain, I was speaking to a couple of older generation opposition people who were talking about how they got reports of human rights abuses out of the country in the 1980s and would speak, for example, about taking letters to Saudi Arabia to post them from there so they wouldn't be intercepted. The contrast with today is obvious and is very dramatic and is something that means that a lot of activist attention now goes on information and communication campaigns in an international sphere. Again, there are pros and cons to this. We're seeing increasingly Gulf struggles over legitimacy play out internationally and play out in Western spaces, in Western capitals, and in Western media. And it is related to the phenomenon that I mentioned before, that the Gulf governments themselves are dependent on international support for at least their hard security against external threats. And therefore, to some extent, it makes sense that their legitimacy also gets challenged and contested in an international arena. And of course, there's a global phenomenon because of the greater globalization of information of social movements linking up internationally and thus that you see young activists in the Gulf engaging with Occupy, engaging with Anonymous, seeing Julian Assange or Bradley Manning as heroes sometimes. And that is a global trend. But it also raises some questions about the focus of politics, sometimes with campaigning both on government and opposition sides being excessively directed towards the presumed wishes and interests of the West, possibly at the expense of building a consensus behind the national interests of the people that really live locally. The final point that I want to make is that it would be very easy for us to assume in these discussions that activism is necessarily opposition activism, and that it's necessarily something that is looking for radical change in the political and economic model of these countries. It's important to bear in mind that activism isn't always oppositional and it isn't always political. There has been an interesting phenomenon in response to opposition activism of seeing a kind of status quo activism or an increased political activism by groups that want to defend the way things are, focus more on criticising the opposition than criticising the government and want to speak positively. You see that both in politics, in Bahrain and Kuwait, with quite vehement attacks on particularly Islamist opposition groups. And you see it in the heated debates, particularly in Saudi Arabia, over people that are deemed to be insulting Islam or speaking in controversial ways about Islam, who have then, for instance, in the case of the young tweeter Hamza Kashgari, faced a real backlash from Twitter users, defying all the stereotypes that social media will make people more liberal and democratic, instead using these technologies to call for him to be killed. One of the forces of change that will be worth paying attention to in the coming years is what happens to these groups of people who've been newly politicized have initially come into politics in order to defend the government and decry those that are seeking change. Already in Bahrain, you're seeing some of those people move position slightly after having an experience of activism, thinking about what else they might be asking for, and indeed seeing that there may also be criticisms that they have of their governments. The question about where they go in the longer term is quite intriguing, but we're certainly seeing a generation in the Gulf that is less able to be politically apathetic, that is less able to see politics as irrelevant to their lives, even if they would prefer it to be that way. Thank you.
Okay, thanks very much, Jane. We'll now turn to Ahmed. Ahmed, can you hear us well?
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes, thanks.
Good morning. First, I just want to take a moment to thank the organizers for inviting me. I'm sorry I could not be in DC because of visa issues, and I really appreciate the flexibility of the organizers and other speakers to make it possible for me to participate through Skype. Kristen and Jane have already covered a lot of ground when it comes to putting recent trends in the Gulf in context, so I want to here to focus on Saudi specifically. The last 2.5 years have been eventful for Saudi Arabia and the whole region, I think. And as the wave of the uprising started and continued in the Arab world, the Saudi government and the Saudi people reacted in different ways to these changes around them. The country did not experience huge or mass street protests as we have seen in other parts of the region, but a small protest movement by the youth of the Shia minority in the eastern part of the country has managed to sustain itself for now, despite the official crackdown. The fact that this movement was leaderless made it difficult for the government to put an end to it, despite the repeated use of force that resulted in the death of at least 15 protesters so far. And 2 police officers are also reported to have been killed in these events. This trend that Kristen mentioned earlier about tribal leaders in Oman failing to calm protesters can also be seen in Saudi, where the government tried to end the protesters by speaking with the Shia leaders to put an end to the movement, but it turns out that the movement is not bound by the Shia leaders. It's the youth, actually, who are taking things into their hands and leading this movement. The other group that also staged continuous small protests is the families of prisoners. In its campaign against Al-Qaeda in early 2000s, the Saudi Arabia arrested a large number of people that they suspected to have links with terrorism. And these people remained in jail without trials for years. Their families have petitioned the government to release them, but to no effect. And out of anger, frustration, and desperation, their families began staging protests outside the Interior Ministry and detention centers around the country, especially in Riyadh and Qassim, in the central part of the country. Now, these families found support from a new organization called the Saudi Civil and Political Rights Association, led by activists Mohammed Al-Ghahtani and Abdullah Al-Hamid. They both were sent in jail in March of this year. Still, the protests continue, and just this week, the female relatives of these prisoners held small protests in 5 different cities across the kingdom, and authorities are reported to have arrested 140 protesters over the past 3 days. Now, in addition to the Shia youth and the families of prisoners, another group that was also inspired by the Arab uprisings is Saudi women. While their calls for lifting the ban on women driving has been a hot button issue since the early 90s, with the demands gaining momentum for some periods before losing steam on others, a younger generation of women activists saw an opportunity in 2011 to push for change. The Women to Drive movement used Twitter and Facebook to mobilize women to challenge the ban. And on June 17, 2011, more than 100 women drove their cars in the streets across the country. Few women were arrested briefly, but the ban is still in place, and the movement does not appear as active anymore. Now, these groups may have differing goals and motivations for the most and motivations, but for the most part, they work almost independently from each other. And they are, but there are two common threads that can, that they all seem to share. First, taking actions on the street to challenge the government. Now, until recently, this has been very unusual. Saudi Arabia is an absolute monarchy that rarely tolerates dissent of that sort. And the Saudi people do not have a political tradition telling them that they can stand up to their government and protest against it in the street. The government also used religion for a long time by urging clerics to issue fatwas against protesters. But now more and more people seem to care less about these religious fatwas, and more groups are willing to take to the street to voice their demands. The other trend that we have seen is the use of the internet and social media to debate, organize, and spread the message about their respective issues. Tools like Facebook and Twitter have become essential for activism, and they have also become the main platform for a freer national discourse in the country where the media remains very censored and people still lack other means of representation and speak in their mind. Now, Twitter in particular has become a phenomenon in Saudi. The social network experienced rapid growth in the country. In 2012, the site said Saudi was the fastest growing country on the platform with more than 4,000% growth at one point in 2012. Today, Saudi has more than 4 million active Twitter users, making it one of the highest rates in the world. The government is, of course, monitoring what's happening on Twitter, and so far, what we have seen is that this has gone through three interesting stages. The first one was censorship. When people started to use Twitter for activism more and more, the government tried to block access to Twitter and Facebook pages of some activists. That's not very useful because, you know, Twitter is a platform. It's not just like web pages. And that's why they can still, these pages, these Twitter accounts can still be accessed through the apps or secure internet protocols. And censorship proved to be really useless and not effective in this case. That made the government move to the next stage of dealing with Twitter, which is by trying to contain what's happening. The government basically in the year 2011 and 2012 tried to reach to influential Twitter users in the country seeking their help to tone down the rhetoric on Twitter and try to make people less critical. But these users basically told the government that they cannot really control what people talk about on Twitter because these conversations are organic and rooted in deep and real grievances. And if there are issues that people really care about, they will still talk about, even if a number of influential people on Twitter who have a lot of users decided to ignore them altogether. The third stage of so that was stage two, which also did not prove to be very useful. The third stage of the government dealing with Twitter was engagement. Now the government realized that this is not going away and censorship and containment are not working. So they began trying to embrace it for their advantage. Today, you have more and more government bodies and officials on Twitter, and even the Crown Prince has a verified, if inactive, account on the service. And the government is really quick to address stories raised on social media. I mean, the latest example happened last week when a video was uploaded of a passport officer beating foreign workers with his belt. And the video was uploaded to YouTube, and the story became really hot on Twitter in about 3 hours. And the very next day, the government came out with a statement saying, we have watched the video and what people are saying, that officer has been arrested for investigation. So that kind of quick reaction by the government shows that now they're really watching this and trying to engage it very quickly because they cannot ignore it anymore. But this is also a useful reminder that, you know, these online tools are agnostic. Anti-government activists can use them, but also the government and its supporters can use them for their advantage, like Jane pointed out earlier. And while the street protests in the country so far has been limited, the debate on Twitter and social media has taken many unprecedented forms. people have become increasingly critical in a way quite unusual for Saudi. And some people may dismiss that as nothing but talk. But remember, even merely talking critically about the government was not usual, you know, a few years before. At some point, these people begin to convert their words into action, like we have seen with the three groups mentioned earlier, the Shia youth, the prisoners' families, and women activists. Now, as these groups and others begin to join forces and work together, the Saudi government will have a more serious challenge ahead of it. Thank you.
Okay, thanks very much, Ahmed. But before I turn to the audience for questions, I just want to ask you if you could follow up and expand a little bit more on what you see as sort of the next phase. You sort of talked about the government's response to Twitter, and I think the same could be said more broadly of the government's response to online activism, and kind of going through these different phases. If I could ask you to say a little bit more about sort of the current state as the government is trying to engage through online media and including Twitter, and or you know how you expect the activists, the various trends of activists, including the Saudi women and Shia youth that you mentioned, are you seeing sort of response now or sort of different approach taken by the activists online in response to the government's sort of changing strategies?
Well, there's a lot of back and forth here. I mean, as the government policy is not limited to Twitter. Sure, they're trying to engage Twitter and social media increasingly, but the government also have more power to act on the ground. And what we have seen is that in addition to engaging more people on Twitter, they are also cracking down more on activists on the ground. So after the trial of Mohammed Al-Qahtani and Abdullah Al-Hamid, and they were sent to jail, the government has upped its crackdown on other activists who have worked closely with these two activists, and many of them have been either interrogated or some of them, like the lawyer of Al-Hamid Al-Qahtani, have been basically forced out to leave the country because he could not deal with government harassment. So the government has been moving in these two directions. The activists now either, you know, they had to make the choice either by escalating their rhetoric and speaking even more strongly against the government, but that could mean that more of them would be sent to jail or interrogated or dealing with the government crackdown. Others decided that it's time to calm down at this point and try to recalculate and see what is the right next course of action for what's going to happen. But so far, it's been each group dealt with it differently. If we looked at the Shia protesters in the Eastern Province, for example, the protest movement is not as active as it used to be, but you know the activists still talk about it as if it's as active. But on the street, we are seeing less frequent street protests as compared to what we have seen before. The same thing for the women drive-in movement, for example. It really had big momentum in 2011 and then started to slowly lose that momentum in the last year. And now we don't see a lot coming from that movement. But maybe the fact that, you know, the king appointed women to the Shura Council who might take the issue of drive-in now, you know, to the government probably would affect that. But each group has dealt with this differently so far.
Okay, thanks very much. I'd like to open up the floor to questions from the audience now. We have a couple of mics coming around, so please wait for the microphone. And if I could ask you to please briefly identify yourself, your name and affiliation, and as Fred said at the outset, try to keep your questions to questions rather than comments or speeches. We'll start here right in the front.
Thank you. Jonathan Broder from Congressional Quarterly. I was wondering if both of you, or all three of you, could address the issue of how these protest groups feel about U.S. policy in the Gulf, and if the United States is U.S. diplomats or NGOs are making efforts to reach out to them.
Okay, thanks. We'll take a few questions together and then come up to the panel for responses. We'll just start right back here. Joe.
Hi. Joe Stork from Human Rights Watch. First question to Ahmed. Hi, Ahmed. You described the similarities between the protest movement in the Eastern Province and the prisoner release protests of the families in Riyadh and so forth. I'd like you to comment on to what extent, what do they think of each other? I mean, they have similarities in terms of their tactics and so forth, but what sort of interaction do they have, if any? Is there kind of a mutual support dynamic there? And then secondly, what was the reaction, if any, on the popular level, the street level, amongst these movements to the conviction and sentencing of Al-Hamad and Khatan? And then for Kristen, I have a question too, if I can. You didn't say anything about the UAE, which has a rather ominous persecution going on of the Islam movement, the local Muslim brothers. But that movement, as far as I'm aware, doesn't really fit the type, or you don't see much, it's not really a youth movement, as far as I'm aware. And I don't know if you've looked at that, but if you could comment on the Brotherhood and the Islamist phenomenon in the UAE. Thank you.
Thanks. And right here in the middle.
Hi, my name is Rachel Peterson. I'm with Americans for Democracy and Human Rights in Bahrain. Thank you all. This has been a really wonderful panel. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the protest movements in each country and how they interact, if at all, with each other. There's been a lot of speculation about whether this is a wider Gulf regional movement or whether each country is really individualized. I'd love to hear your opinions on that.
Okay, great. We'll take some responses from our panelists now. Kristen, if you'd like to start, maybe you'd like to start with Joe's question on the UAE.
Sure. Yes, when we look at the Muslim Brotherhood, I didn't really, in my remarks, I was looking at kind of one general trend, but if you look at the relationship between the Muslim Brotherhood and Gulf governments, it's obviously a lot of differences. I mean, you can see across the Gulf. You have some areas where the Muslim Brotherhood was able to have a lot more space to kind of organize and to play a much deeper sort of role in society. I'd say that's true in Kuwait. It's also true in Saudi Arabia with Muslim Brotherhood-related networks that were established that were given quite a lot of space to organize. In other states, they were given, were always seen with much more, or especially more recently seen with a lot more suspicion. UAE would definitely be one of those. So I think the kind of, particularly since the death of Sheikh Zayed, I think the new government has always had a deep suspicion about the Muslim Brotherhood and seen them as an organization that could be threatening to the state. And so I think they've had a lot less room, in a way, to organize and to pursue these different kind of modes of interaction. Of course, Bahrain would be interesting to mention as well. The situation in Bahrain is very different, where the Muslim Brotherhood has had very close ties with the government and has been a strong ally of the government there, which relates a lot to the sectarian dynamic there. But even in Bahrain, you see interesting divisions opening up. We had, even during the protests, the Fatah Youth Movement that broke away from the main Muslim Brotherhood movement. There's a lot of debates about what exactly that was going on there, if this was a movement that was wanting to press demands even further. I think it was probably much more related to ruling family dynamics and things that were happening, which is another important dynamic that I hope will be discussed later. When you get a lot of divisions in ruling families, how they interact with a lot of these different societal divisions in ways that affect the dynamics of the states too.
Thanks. Ahmed, if you'd like to take, there were a couple questions directed to you, including Joe Stork's question on what the various trends and movements that you identified think of each other. If you could also talk a little bit about how the younger generation of protesters in the Gulf view U.S. policy, and then also if you have any thoughts on how these different trends interact with similar trends in other countries across the Gulf.
Well, I think, let me begin with with the question regarding how activists feel about U.S. policy. I think, you know, for many people in the protest movement and Saudi and activists who have worked actively in the past 2 years, you know, while they work, they think they work in, independently, and they don't, they say that they are not waiting or expecting U.S. support. At the same time, there seems to be frustration about the fact that the U.S. has ignored a lot of the crackdown against activists, and in, especially in the latest case, the trials of Al-Hamad and Al-Qahtani, you know, despite a lot of media attention in U.S. media to the case, the U.S. government did not really speak about it. And even though, you know, close to the trial, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry was in Saudi, and also the U.S. Minister of Justice was also in Saudi, and they both did not talk about the cases, which was, you know, it was something that a lot of people find strange, and they were expecting that the U.S. would come with stronger statement about these trials and the crackdown on general against activists in the country. Now, when it comes to different trends and ideology, as I have said earlier, we have many different groups here acting in their own sphere. So the Shia youth movement in the Eastern Province, you know, seems to be working on its own, and it does not seem to get a lot of support or sympathy from other groups of the country, especially, for example, from the prisoners' families and their supporters who happen to be, you know, Sunni Salafists who don't have a lot of sympathy for the Shia. So even though they both are asking the government for similar grievances about, you know, releasing their prisoners and end of discrimination, they do not really identify with each other, even if some of their causes seem to be similar. And, you know, the same goes for the women rights movement. For example, again, they seem to be working on their own and not really, they do not seem to receive a lot of support from other groups or activists, which is, so far has been a trend in the country when it comes to activism, that, you know, NGOs are not allowed in the country. So these activists are working individually with each other, but they are not able to formalize their links into any special bodies that can function. So they work, you know, they're working as groups online, but they're not really, they cannot form any official bodies to tackle these issues. And at the same time, many of these groups have a hard time approaching each other or sympathizing with each other in order to work with each other. And it seems very obvious that if these groups manage to work together, they will present a greater challenge to the government. But so far, the government has also been very smart about dividing these groups and making sure, that they do not work together, that, you know, let the Shia work on their own and let the women rights movement limit it to women rights, and, you know, leave these prisoners, families prisoners, working on their own, and do not let them work together.
Can I get also to respond to the question about what the response has been by some of these movements to the government's tactic of cracking down, and some, especially the two arrests that you mentioned of bloggers in the Eastern Province? How has that affected these movements? What's the response been?
I mean, when the crackdown first begins, a lot of people seem intimidated. A lot of activists will have to face the choice of either continue to work and take the risk of being a victim of the government crackdown, which means either, you know, getting interrogated or being sent to jail, or trying to go underground and maybe quiet down a little until this crackdown eases a little bit, and then maybe they can come back to activism again. But it's really difficult because, you know, many of the government crackdown do not seem very specific regarding specific actions. It's not like these activists know that when I do this or say that, that's when I cross the government red line and that's when the government will come after me. Because what we have seen is that in some cases, you know, the government seemed to chase some activists over, you know, some tweets, for example, while in other cases, some activists maybe did work on the ground by being in protest, but still managed to stay out of jail and avoid government harassment.
Jane, I don't know if you'd like to comment on this question about the interaction among some of these different activists and protest movements across the different countries in the Gulf.
There's certainly not a concerted regional movement, despite the fact that there are many common demands that have been there for a long time. That, you know, there's a large number of people in the region that could build a consensus around looking for a constitutional monarchy, with people who are seeking a republic still quite firmly in the minority. But organisationally, it's just not happening. You do, of course, see activists in the different GCC states paying a lot of attention to each other. They also paid attention to other Arab uprisings, and particularly the protests in Jordan and Morocco also resonated with people in the Gulf monarchies. But still, they're mainly seeking changes within the nation-state frameworks that they have. Even the Muslim Brotherhood is not making a transnational push in the Gulf because its relationship with each different government is very different. And indeed, the Gulf governments are quite divided over how to deal with the Muslim Brotherhood, with the UAE and Qatar at pretty much opposite ends of a spectrum. Sectarian divisions are one of the factors that are hindering cooperation. So it is possible, for instance, to speak to some Shia leaders in Kuwait who would say, well, it's terrible that in Bahrain they lock people up for criticising the king on Twitter. And then you ask them about what do you think of the Kuwaiti government doing the same thing? And they say, oh, well, that's completely different because here in Kuwait, everything's wonderful. And, you know, vice versa, you would see the same thing with some of the pro-government Sunnis in Bahrain. So yeah, it's still not really a region-wide movement. I also wanted, if I may, to touch on this question about criticisms of the US. I think you see, of course, a lot of criticisms of US policies from people in the opposition and also people in the governments regarding the US policies in the wider region, especially on Israel, Iraq, and to some extent Syria. The US is kind of caught between a rock and a hard place because for opposition groups, they see the US firmly siding with their governments, while the governments are very sensitive to US rhetoric about democracy promotion, and of course were deeply troubled by the US stance on Mubarak, even though in reality the resources that the US gives to the regimes are much greater than any civil society and democracy promotion programs in terms of the security cooperation. The language of democracy makes the regimes nervous, while the opposition movements think that it's just a fig leaf. The US can't really win. I think also you see it some difference between some of the organized opposition groups who are quite pragmatic, who want to get the US on side, and who will therefore say, you know, we're not too worried about US having military bases here, and more radical opposition groups that are loudly criticizing the US. So on my recent visit to Bahrain, for instance, in Sitra, which is a village that's a bit of a hotspot for unrest, I noticed posters of Obama and the British Prime Minister, which were labelled, you know, terrorists. They're supporting repression in Bahrain. And there's clearly been a move by the more radical opposition there to put more and more blame on the US. And just finally on the UAE, this clampdown on the Muslim Brotherhood is creating an atmosphere that some have described as almost McCarthyite in wider society, where many people who in the past were mildly critical of the government are now feeling that they need to show their loyalty in the face of this apparent threat. And this creates quite a challenge for young people who want to take a more active role in politics and society, but don't want to be seen as dissidents. You do have people that are trying to carve out a space for themselves as patriotic activists, if you like, so declaring their great support for the leadership, but saying, you know, perhaps there are ways that you could include young people more in your decision making to help support the greatness of your vision.
Okay, thanks. We'll return back to another round of questions from the audience. We start here with Greg on the side.
Thank you. Greg Aftandilian with the Center for National Policy. The Gulf Arab states send tens of thousands of students to Europe and the United States for education. And I'm just curious, since the uprisings in the Arab world began in 2011, the perhaps ideological trends that we may be seeing among these students, have they come back to their home countries with different ideas, interacting, say, with Egyptian students or other students, you know, at these universities? I mean, what is the impact of this large group of students being educated outside? Thank you.
Thanks. In the back.
Eamon Geeran from Johns Hopkins. I wonder, with all of the discussion of leaderless groups and so much of the debate happening online, are there any channels that are for activists to talk to regimes that are less public? Mm. And do the activists indeed want these?
And just here?
No. Hi, Cynthia with the Harbor Group. I'm actually wondering, Ahmed, if there is any particular government structure that these youth movements may see that could act as a model that they're striving for. And also, just a question for anyone as to whether or not we think it's possible to get a lot of these movements to interact and possibly become a coalition. Or is that out of the question?
Okay. Ahmed, why don't you begin there with that last question to you. Are there structures that the youth movements could emulate or try to emulate as models? And or are there, do you have any thoughts on sort of efforts to encourage the sort of disparate movements that you identified to work together more than they have been?
No, I don't think that there are any like government structures that these group, these youth movements can emulate, because the government had only one government body that deals with youth, and it's mainly concerned with sports more than anything else. And I don't think there are any local models that these youth groups can emulate. But as Kristen talked about earlier, some of the Islamist groups, like the Muslim Brotherhood, had the similar structures for years. And, you know, they acted in Saudi in a way that is not very official. So they're there, they're operating, and they organize their activities. But because they're not official, only tolerated by the government, that means that the government can stop them and crack down on them at any time. As what we have seen last year, for example, with another forum that was organized by a group of people close to the Muslim Brotherhood, and you know, they did the organization and everything and announced it and invited people, and in the last minute the government decided to cancel the event, and there was nothing that these could do. And this was in Kuwait, I think, but most of the participants were in Saudi. So there are no really no government structures to emulate. There are some other alternatives, but even those are not functioning formally.
Okay, thanks, Jane. If you'd like to address either some of these questions about the return of students from abroad, as well as challenges that may be less public.
The international students is a major factor driving change, but it's not a simple one. Certainly, it does mean that you have a large group from the Gulf that are exposed to a much wider range of political and social possibilities. And often it's difficult for people, especially when they go back to very conservative societies, to readjust. In the case of Bahrain, some of the leaders of the protest movement were people who had PhDs from the US and Britain, and also people who had postgraduate degrees from Cairo and who had observed what the youth movements there were up to. At the same time, you have many people that go abroad, get Western degrees and come back and work for governments. And the governments invest quite heavily in scholarships for students overseas, and that's something that also some people can be grateful for and feel was an investment that was made in them that they would like to repay. Another trend that you see is that a lot of students that go overseas to study then go back and get involved in education at home. For instance, in Kuwait, if you have a government scholarship, that's what you're expected to do, to go and teach at the public university. And there is now a change in academia in some parts, particularly in Kuwait and in Qatar, which are the most academically open, where traditionally there has not been very much study of the Gulf in the Gulf. And ironically, people have come to Britain, which is the home of a lot of the imperial records, or they've come to America to study their country in somewhere that's less constrained than at home. But you're now beginning to see that being kind of re-indigenized, that this sort of new generation of sociologists, historians, political scientists, and so on are studying the Gulf in the Gulf, which is tremendously important. In terms of less public channels through which activists talk to regimes, I mean, there's all sorts of... In the small Gulf countries, you do get social connections. You know, you may see through Ramadan, for instance, in Bahrain, there might be scope for people meeting at social gatherings to talk informally about some of the political issues that are dividing them. But there's not enough. There's not enough of this going on. And I think one of the reasons that many activists are turning to Western media and to social media and so on is that they don't feel that there are enough effective channels, either formally or informally, back at home to have that dialogue in a meaningful way.
If I may comment on the students thing, I mean, Saudi has the largest number of Saudi students abroad in the region, and like more than 100,000 Saudi students study in the US and Europe and other countries. But it's important to remember that Saudi is very specific about the majors that these students study. So they are sent to study majors like medicine, engineering, but not things like political science, for example. And, you know, there are very few who do that, but these are rather the exception, because the government is very specific about what kind of majors these students go to study in foreign schools. Students are also always reminded to avoid taking part in politics in their foreign universities, and avoid political debates and participate in political groups. So, you know, when I was studying in the U.S., we received these emails constantly from the embassy saying, you know, do not talk to the media. Do not do this. Do not do that. So the government is sending all these students abroad, but they're also specific about what majors they study, and they're watching their activities when they're in these schools. Now, when they come back to Saudi, that's another challenge for the government, because all of these people will come back with these degrees, but there are not a lot of jobs available to them. Now, they're not expected to work in the government because the government cannot hire any more people, but there are not enough good jobs available for them in the private sector, which has been, for the most part, employing foreigners and not Saudis. So what we have seen is that there is a lot of frustration among these young students when they come back from colleges abroad trying to find jobs, and they don't find them, which either pushes them to go back again and leave the country again. And I have seen several cases where students will go to the US, get a degree, come back, gets really frustrated with the situation, not being able to find a job, and also being frustrated with the political and social restrictions after not having to deal with these restrictions for 4 or 5 years abroad, and many of them would seek a way to get out of the country again, which is really worrying because it seems that Saudi might be facing some sort of a brain drain in the coming years if that continues.
Thanks. Kristen?
Yeah, if I could just add to that, I mean, especially in the case of Saudi Arabia, that the change between living abroad and coming home does come as somewhat of a shock. And I've been really interested to see how a lot of these movements are dealing with that. And it's not explicitly political, but there's a lot of ferment in ideas and in thinking about ways to create more space and in sort of cultural change. But when you're looking at a state like Saudi Arabia, where you know, Wahhabism and religion is a formal part of the state that really structures society and structures state authority, the kind of intellectual things that I see happening with a lot of young people trying to think about different relationships between Islam and the state is really a means of like opening up space. So I think one area to look at when you're looking for change and kind of long-term change in Saudi Arabia is the entry of a lot of young people willing to kind of write and challenge these ideas on the intellectual level. And you've had some interesting people like Abdullah al-Maliki, who's been writing some things that are looking to kind of reshape the relationship between Islam and the state and to kind of pick away at the restrictions that you see in the Wahhabist order. And I see a lot of these young people, too, not doing explicitly political things, but having kind of literature forum and things like that in ways where they can engage with ideas. The issue of people going back to the States, it can also affect the organization of student groups in the States can also affect things differently. The case of Kuwait is very interesting to look at in this arena, because in Kuwait they have extremely well-organized student movements, both inside Kuwait universities and abroad, and all of the political movements use those youth movements to bring up their future leaders, and so they pay close attention to them. There's actually a lot of money in these movements. And what's really fascinating is that the very first youth movement in Kuwait that took these new techniques that emerged in 2005, pushing for a change in the electoral system, actually emerged from the branch, came out of a lot of dynamics that happened in the United States, where you had some of the young leaders there frustrated with the formal boundaries that existed between kind of Islamists and secularists and other people who weren't being organized in these formal movements, and overturned that through kind of a new youth movement that looked to organize them, a youth party that won the elections in the United States. And then those leaders were the ones who were instrumental in returning back to Kuwait and pushing the kind of change, the political change that happened. And so you saw, in a way, this distance in the States and a lot of kind of very savvy political leaders able to use that to overcome some of these divisions that we're talking about that have been a real impediment to change. One just quick comment, too, on if the states, how the states are relating to youth movements. Kuwait has actually been very active in this regard, and they've been reorganizing their youth ministry, as they mentioned. A lot of them have to do with sports, to focus on different things. And they also had an initiative that came directly from the Amiri Diwan to address this whole issue of dissatisfaction of youth. And it was really interesting. They've recruited a lot of people. And when I met with the ministries, they said what they were really interested in doing was finding quick wins, so to show that they've been able to respond to this demand that youth are asking for change and to show that they're listening. In fact, the whole program was called Kuwait Tisma, so Kuwait is listening. And they came out then through a very formal kind of conference that was attended by the emir and the prime minister and all of the elite. They had the youth and addressed their concerns to the government. And they acted on some of these in doing things like, allowing for more investment in small businesses and things that young people were asking for on the economic level. None of the main arenas that the youth came up with for asking for change were asking for direct political change, which shows you a way that they could kind of use this forum but still allow them to address some concerns that the youth had. It's interesting, though, because when I talked to the activists and what they thought about this, a lot of them hadn't even heard of it. And the ones who did hear of it said, well, you can think about Kuwait listening being in a very positive way. You can think of it as a very kind of frightening way, given the kind of suppression that's happening with a lot of the activists on Twitter. And when I asked them, well, do you think this shows that the youth is, that the government is really responding and listening? They said, well, this is just a way to circumvent actually listening to us. And he held up his phone and said, this government is just completely out of the coverage area. So that was his way of saying how he felt the government was not listening to what they were doing.
Okay, thanks. We'll open up for a last set of questions from the audience. Start right here.
Dick Rosen with the Council for a Community of Democracies. Apropos of the earlier question from the Congressional Quarterly person about reaction to U.S. policy and what diplomats and military people and others were doing about that, the Community of Democracies has commissioned a series of handbooks. One is for diplomats, not just American diplomats, but all diplomats in the community, as to how they might react in situations where their bilateral responsibilities as diplomats are supplemented by the problems presented by people who come to them for help on democracy questions. And the military people, the same way. So these two handbooks are designed to encourage the participation by diplomats and military leaders in democratic transitions. My question is whether there is any evidence from the Middle East of actions on the part of diplomats and military leaders at these lower levels, not just at the Secretary of State level, but at some of the lower levels, to work with, encourage, or otherwise aid and abet the situations with which they're faced when they're on duty.
Thanks. Do we have any other questions from the audience this time? Yes, in the back.
Hi, Laith Abdullah. I just wanted to ask if you could maybe elaborate on your definition of activism in the region.
Could you speak up a bit more? Sorry.
Okay. I just wanted to ask if you could maybe elaborate on your definition of activism in the region, because we've been hearing a lot about protests and protest movements, and I think that activism in the region might go beyond that. So if you could just hear more about that, please.
Sure. Any other questions from the audience? Okay. I'll also add in another question, which is something that also may come up in our later panel today as well. One country that hasn't been mentioned at all, today we're focusing on, of course, the Arab states of the Gulf, but one country that hasn't really come up is Iran. And you hear quite a lot, especially from some of the governments in the Arabian Peninsula, about sort of the fear and the threat of Iran. And, of course, that's something that's discussed quite a lot here in Washington. And a lot of the countries that we're discussing today are often viewed through the lens of sort of, counterbalance to Iran across the Gulf. I'd like to ask if our panelists have thoughts on sort of views of Iran, and not just of the Iranian government. Today is Iran's presidential election. During Iran's last presidential election 4 years ago, we saw a sizable protest movement emerge there. And I was just wondering if there are any thoughts on perceptions of Iran and how that affects sort of some of the dynamics of some of these movements that we've been discussing so far. If we could maybe, Kristen, if we'll start with you, if you have thoughts on really any of the questions that were raised here.
Sure. I'll start with just one issue on the question of activism. I think it's a good point, and in fact, even amongst young people, you see in some of these states kind of an exhaustion about the kind of very direct political action demanding change to the state. There are some, we should mention that there are a lot of people who are kind of tiring of this. And we do have to understand that in some of these states, many of these states, people have a lot to lose. And when we see the activism reaching really a high point and seeing a lot of social divisions that have come from that, that is concerning to some people, that this is kind of rising to a level that might be threatening to people's kind of economic welfare and these sorts of things. So much as like Jane talked about earlier, you have kind of a backlash against that. And I've seen in Kuwait in particular kind of a move like that there's too much politics and that we really need to work on much more concrete things, not at the high political level, but to make our local kind of areas better. There's been kind of, in line with this kind of rise in volunteerism, movements to try to clean and build new parks and beautify kind of local neighborhoods and things like that. So I think this is in some sense kind of a backlash against the kind of intensity of politics that we've seen in the last couple of years, and especially as we should mention that the effect and the kind of pathway that a lot of the other states in the region are taking have a huge impact, I think, on the dynamics within the Gulf states as well. There was a lot of interest, a lot of euphoria, a lot of positive thinking about what was happening in Egypt and Tunisia, for instance, in the early days that was contagious in the Gulf region. But as those situations have gotten more difficult, have you seen polarization between the Muslim Brotherhood and secular movements in Egypt? Of course, as we've seen Syria, which is a huge issue, just descend into this horrible violence, it's made a lot of people step back. It's resulted in a lot of divisions in the movements themselves over the questions of the role of the Muslim Brotherhood and what they're trying to do. That has shown up on the ground in the Gulf as well. It's obviously had a huge impact on any ability to have a cross-sectarian alliances. It's become much more difficult with Syria. And also just the sense that change could be very costly, I think, has permeated, and people thinking that maybe we're better to step back. So it's important to keep an eye on those kind of international dynamics too.
Jane?
I would take a broad definition of activism as being essentially about trying to take a role as more active citizens, which is especially interesting in these countries that are often perceived as being countries where citizens just depend on the government economically and politically for everything. I think all of us said more than once that it's not just about protest and not just about opposition, which is why we've been discussing volunteerism, social media, literary fora, etc. And the sort of patriotic activism I mentioned in a country like the UAE, where there are no actual street protests. So it's really about not just asking governments to give people more of a role, but about people proactively taking more of a role, whether that's in politics or in society or in intellectual debates. On Iran, I think this fear of external threats is a systematic problem in the Gulf. The Gulf monarchies have a lot of factors for their stability. And on one hand, it's a great advantage to have small populations combined with a great deal of economic resources. But the downside is that as small states with very limited military capabilities of their own, they're systematically worried about external threats. So in the case of Bahrain and Saudi, the current concerns are particularly centering on Iran. In Kuwait, of course, historically it's centered on Iraq. And traditionally, going back to the 50s and 60s, the fears were more about Egypt. And that's what we see coming up again in the UAE, the fear that the Muslim Brotherhood from Egypt could be trying to destabilize the country there. And this is where the US can actually play a helpful role with the Gulf countries, because the US is the main power that is reassuring the Gulf governments that it will protect them against external threats. But maybe there is some quid pro quo in terms of expecting a somewhat more inclusive bargain with the domestic population. Right now, that's not really working. However, the Gulf states do seem to think that the US government is underestimating the role of Iran, the role of the transnational Muslim Brotherhood, and so on.
Thanks. And Ahmed, I'll turn to you to give you your response on all of these questions.
I think Jane and Kristen already covered most of that, so I won't repeat what they said. I just want to add one example about the wide definition of activism, that not just about demand and things from the government, but also expands to other forms like literature and volunteerism and other forms. And I think one interesting example that we have seen in Saudi and the Gulf in the last couple of years is a rise of a contemporary art movement, where a lot of young Saudi and other Gulf artists are using graphic design and sculptures and other forms of art to add political and social commentary on what's happening in their countries. And what's really interesting about the rise of this movement is that while many of it is political commentary and some of it is very daring, it cannot really be censored, because as artists, they use subtle forms to express their opinions and surprisingly, so far, this movement actually has been really growing, and we have seen a lot of these artists showing their art, not just across the Gulf and the region, but also in Europe, the U.S., and other places. And I think, you know, the rise of that art movement is also an interesting example of a wider definition of activism that, that Jin have already mentioned.
So if I could get you also to respond, there was this question about the role of diplomats and particularly lower level diplomats. And I was wondering if you've seen sort of any actions that you see as constructive by foreign diplomats in the Gulf, you know, particularly in Saudi, that ways in which they've, you know, tried to show some sympathy toward you know, some of the, these reform movements and movements of activism that you've discussed. Often they're sort of trying to strike a balance and avoid antagonizing the host government. But I was wondering if you had any thoughts on any examples that you may have seen along those lines.
My understanding is that U.S. diplomats in Saudi usually try to reach out to these activists and speak with them. But they're also, as you said, very limited in what they can do because they don't want to antagonize their host country, so they're very careful about how they approach this. So while they try to, you know, talk to these people to understand the issues and report on them, they can't really do much because there's a lot of limits and restrictions on what they can do.
I just add one point on that. There was a very interesting case in Bahrain, I mean, I think where one diplomat who was seen as just engaging, kind of doing his job and engaging with the opposition, was actually targeted by a lot of the pro-government movements. And there was a big campaign kind of to vilify him, to link him, I think, with Israel or something at the time to kind of do this kind of thing. And he was actually removed from the country. The Americans cut short his tour of duty. And even since that time, you've seen some very active campaigns to mobilize and to sort of shame the U.S. government if it's taking a position too close to the opposition that takes place as a way to sort of intimidate and to keep, I think, to affect effectively U.S. policy on the ground. So I think the governments and some of the civil society movements are very aware of this and have used that as a way to try to lessen the scope or the ability of the U.S. government to play that role.
And you've seen a similar campaign against the current U.S. ambassador in Bahrain and against the previous British ambassador in Bahrain on the basis that they've met with representatives of opposition groups, even though it's a fairly routine thing. But more subtly, in at least one other Gulf country, U.S. diplomats are being actively discouraged from speaking, even in off-the-record briefings to journalists about the current political situation. But that's probably a more effective means of control because it's being done very much behind closed doors. And I don't mention the country name precisely because I can't prove it. I just know what I hear from the journalists. I think, you know, diplomats do meet with dissidents, and the US is more forward-leaning on that than the UK and some European governments. But it's not necessarily a democracy promotion thing. It's also a way of getting intelligence and information. And then we haven't seen much in the way of public statements trying to protect those people when some of those people that routinely met with foreign diplomats end up going to jail, sometimes with charges that directly relate to speaking with foreign governments, defaming the country, distorting the country's image and things like that. We're always told that such things are brought up behind closed doors, but again, it's very difficult to prove.
Right. I would also add one other thing that I know it's been done in several of the Gulf countries is some of the activists or dissidents that have been arrested or faced charges. You've seen diplomats from various countries, including the United States and European countries, often attend the trials of these activists. And in some cases, their attending of the trials has angered the governments. In other cases, they've attended the trials but then said nothing publicly, and the opposition has actually often been very critical because they fear that their attendance at the trials without commenting on what's widely perceived to be sort of irregularities and the trials not being up to international standards may lend an endorsement to processes that are often seen as unfair. Thanks very much to all our panelists for this excellent discussion. We're going to take a short 15-minute break, and then we're going to move on to the next panel at 10:45. Thanks.
Thank you.